Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When we talk about the opioid crisis, it can become an impersonal, faceless, amorphous problem, something to be addressed by policy changes and discussions with doctors and health officials and lawmakers. But elevating the problem to the crisis level and looking at addiction from 30,000 feet means you can lose the contours of the very real faces of the people who are dealing with addiction. Today, we're going to listen back to a program that first aired in April. We tried to touch down from that aerial flight over the opioid landscape and talk with two Vermonters who have experiences of addiction to share, Trish Lafayette of Bristol and Scott Pavick of Burlington. Trish and Scott joined me in our Colchester studio, and I started by asking Trish when she first began using opioids and how it happened.
Sure. So my addiction began shortly after a surgery. So I was overweight and had the gastric bypass surgery and was prescribed a lot of liquid Percocet.
And when you were prescribed liquid Percocet, presumably that was because you really had needed some help with the pain. So you were taking liquid Percocet. And when did you realize you were starting to divert it or take more than you were supposed to?
I realized at the end, towards the end of that that medical journey. And then I continued on to my family doctor where I started asking for more. And it was very easy to get. She gave me as much as I wanted.
When you started asking for more, did you think to yourself, this is probably not good? Or did you think, I need something to deal with the pain? I mean, when did you start to realize this is veering into territory that feels uncomfortable to me?
Yeah. So in the beginning of going to my family doctor and using, I did have real physical body pain that was unanswered and the doctors couldn't figure out why, but it was real pain. I realized that it was a problem when those prescriptions started running out too early.
So what did you do then when you thought this is running out too early?
I dealt with it for a little while, and then I realized that I was going to have to tell my doctor so that she could help me. So I told her.
And what did she say?
She confessed to knowing, and she said that she understood and that she was going to address that with me in a couple of weeks, and that this was going to be the last prescription and that we were going to wean off of it together.
But that didn't happen?
No.
What happened?
By the time I came back 2 weeks later, I did wean off of it myself. And then I stayed clean for probably 2 months. And each week, day that went by, I was just having heavier and heavier cravings. And the fight just got harder and harder to deal with. And I knew that I couldn't go back to her because I had already confessed to her that I was abusing it. So I began street buying on my own.
How do you make that first step into street buying? Because that must be something where in your head you're thinking, I don't even know who to call, but Then you go do it.
Unfortunately, it's not that hard. It's really easy. If you know anybody who you think is in that kind of situation, it's a simple question and they lead you to the right person. And it doesn't even take longer than 20 minutes and you can be hooked up.
Scott, what about for you? How did you start using opioids?
I was 16 when I had my first experience with opioids, and it wasn't through a prescription or a medical setting. I just happened to be out with friends, I guess. I was living in Barrie at the time. I met a friend who happened to have a pill that day. I was already drinking pretty heavily at the time in my youth. I would say my substance use disorder had already begun, but I was just offered that medication one day. I took it. And that same night, I decided to come back to that, I guess, apartment complex and try to find more on my own.
How did you do that?
Truthfully, I just went to the first door that seemed to be the right location of where I was previously that day, knocked and just started asking for a woman who I thought had supplied it to us. Eventually, the people just, I guess, got us connected.
Why? What was the draw? What made you think, I need to have more of this after just that first pill?
Truthfully, it was, I guess, an infatuation. There wasn't, you know, a same-day need that was established. I wasn't sick without it, but there was just a curiosity and, I guess, an intense euphoria with that first use. And I just happened to be a pretty depressed, anxious, and lonely teenager. And, you know, having a substance that can take all of those feelings away instantaneously was mighty appealing at the time.
When you took that first pill, did you have a sense that it might lead to something bad, or is it more a sense of, sure, I'm with friends, this sounds fun?
I couldn't tell you what was running through my head in the moment. It was pretty quick. I don't think there was a whole lot of thought there. And certainly if I was aware of the consequences now, I mean, I don't see myself making that same decision.
So you went back to the apartment complex. You got hooked up with the person or someone who could supply you with more pills. And that was on that very first night. What happened? How did that lead you into a path where you were using more?
I can't really tell you. I try to run through my head and see where the progression started, but I know it was while I was still in high school that my friends started to point out to me that all I talked about was opioid medications and finding opiates and using. I didn't really understand I had a problem until I think I was working a shift at a local restaurant, and it had been my first experience, I think, going more than a day without using, and my first time really experiencing withdrawal or feeling sick. And I was just in the walk-in, shaking and sweating, and a waitress came up to me and told me that she knew why I was sick. That was the moment where I started to realize that this was beyond my control.
Did you do something in that moment? Did you reach out and grab the hand that she was offering?
Truthfully, she didn't offer much of a hand. It was just more status quo that this is what you are now or what you do now. I know that while I was in high school, my mother did her best to get me involved with outpatient programs, but truthfully, just nothing stuck at that moment.
So did your family know what you were going through? And did they know because they could sense or because you told them?
It was really just my mom and I. And I think she understood but didn't want to know the exact details at the time. And eventually, we just reached the point where while I was in high school, she had to ask me to leave the house.
How did you fund your addiction, Scott?
Over the time, it changes. You know, I was in active addiction for 5 years of my life while I had legitimate jobs. Most of that money was going there, you know, trying to skip out on rent and utilities and anything else that mattered while you absolutely could. And truthfully, when you don't have money, but your body tells you you need to use, you just find a way.
How about for you, Trish? How did you find the money?
My story is similar to his story. I had a job and I didn't pay my bills. I got behind on the bills, and the most important thing to me was finding money to use.
So when you get behind on the bills and you're finding money, you know, do you borrow from people? Do you tell them why you're borrowing money? I mean, do people know and not want to know, as Scott said?
Oh, sure. Like, my family is really close and very supportive, and there'd be times that I would be short on money and I'd borrow money and they would give it to me. They never put the puzzle pieces together until the end when I finally went to them and went to rehab. Then they started, oh, that's why you needed money. But they didn't know at the time, and you surely don't tell them.
Hmm. Trish, you mentioned that you started using because you had a prescription for liquid Percocet. And so you were using prescription opioids and maybe misusing or abusing them, but they were prescription medication that you were using. During the time that you were actively using, did you stick with prescription medication the entire time, or did you switch over to heroin and other opioids?
I switched over to heroin. So I started street buying, like I said, and I street bought on and off. There was times where I had a couple months where I had motivation and I was strong, but my dealer came to me and said, we don't have any more Percocet, and we're not going to have any for a few days, and why don't you just try this? And that's how I got started on heroin.
How did you use?
I was scared of the needle and I never used the needle, but I snorted it.
Did heroin feel different from Percocet?
Instantly. It's a faster, better high, quicker, cheaper.
So once you switch over to heroin, is there any reason to go back to Percocet, or is that like, oh, this is better?
No, there's no reason to go back. I never asked to go back, and she never had any intention of getting me back either. But it's... No, you don't want to go back. It's cheaper. It's better high. It's quicker.
When you say she never had any intention of you going back, what's the motivation for a dealer to switch you over to heroin?
They know that you're going to get more addicted quicker. You're going to buy more from them. They can lace it with things. You know, with a pill, you can look up the code and you're sort of safe. When you get into heroin, they can do much more things with it and make more money off of it.
Did you know all of that at the time?
No. No. Now, looking back, I certainly know, but I didn't at the time. I thought she was on my side and was out for the best for me, and she wasn't. She was on the best for herself.
So you had a relationship with your dealer?
Yes. Yep.
How did that relationship work when you say you thought she was on your side. You know, can you take me inside that relationship a little bit?
Sure. She just acted like, you know, she was the best friend and totally understanding why you needed it. Would show up at any given time, day, night, do the fastest drive-by, drop-off.
You mean like she'd do delivery? She'd deliver
to your front door, yep. And just make it really easy for you and act very concerning and caring for you and your family. And that wasn't true. She cared for herself and her people.
Was she using, do you know?
Yes, she's still using and dealing.
Huh. Scott, does that resonate with you? I mean, does that sound familiar or is your experience different?
That's essentially the same story. I guess the detail I'd add is that just something changed when I understand the formulations for these medications change. And eventually there was a time, I believe, between 2010, 2011, where the formulation for OxyContin had been changed. It was harder to abuse. And I just know that that was the beginning of a whole new cohort of heroin users when you could no longer use the medications that had been previously available. You had no choice but to switch substances to satisfy that craving.
And did you use heroin as well?
I truthfully experimented with heroin once, and when it got too much for me, when I saw what happened when my friends continued to experiment with that, I decided to seek out ways of weaning myself off opiate medications on my own. That led to a lot of experimentation with substitution of substances on my own, which certainly didn't do me much good. So at the time, I thought I was doing better by using XYZ substance as opposed to heroin, all the while continuing to abuse opiate medications on top of that.
Let's go to a call here. Tom is on the line with us from Newport. Hi, Tom. Go right ahead.
Hi. Couple things. First, my own experience, I've probably been prescribed opioids, Vicodin, OxyContin for pain after surgery as many as 8 or 10 times in my life. And I've never needed to use more than need the pain relief for more than a few days at a time. And it was easy for me to just stop when the pain, I wasn't experiencing the pain. And I've always heard that as long as opioids are addressing physical pain, you're not going to become habituated or addicted. And yet I know others, like my own family members, that had a very hard time stopping using them when they were prescribed for pain. And then one other thing, my father just went through amputation surgery. My brother, who was responsible for his care, chose to use only Tylenol, not the morphine and OxyContin that were available for my dad's pain. My dad was not really able to make his own decisions at the time. I wondered about the wisdom of that. It seemed to me he went through an awful lot of needless pain because the Tylenol wasn't really addressing his pain. So how do you make the call as to when these drugs are appropriate for pain and when they're likely to become a problem in your life?
Well, Tom, thanks for sharing your call and your questions. And I want to say right at the outset here, none of the three of us are medical professionals. So that question of when is it appropriate to use what medication, I think, is better left for another show. And we can link you to a show we did recently about pain and specifically about dealing with pain in the context of opioid use and some studies that seem to suggest that perhaps other forms of non-opioid medication are as effective in dealing with pain as opioids are. But your other question seems to point to the fact that different people experience opioids differently. And for one person, taking that opioid for pain doesn't actually trigger something inside of them that wants or craves more, and yet other people have a problem. And Trish, I'm wondering if you could address that part.
Sure, I'd like to. So there's a difference between addiction and being dependent. So I think you're talking like, you know, some people take the prescribed medication for pain, and then they can let go of it very easily. And, you know, another person takes it and continues. Well, for myself, when I was taking the gastric bypass medication, the liquid Percocet, I wasn't addicted. I wasn't dependent. I mean, I was addicted by choice. Like I knew that it numbed my other feelings, my mental health problems, my depression, my anxiety, my abusive relationship. So I knew that that medication just made me feel really good inside. So I became addicted mentally, but my body was not dependent. And I think that sets aside a good difference between people.
You said there were times where you would sort of wean yourself off for a couple months at a time. And did you feel the physical symptoms of withdrawal that would suggest that your body was dependent?
Not in the early stages. It took a while. It took a long time with just using Percocet before withdrawals. I mean, like, at least a year or more before I would say that I was dependent. Heroin is another story. You start heroin, you do that regularly, you're going to be sick just a few days into it. But I wasn't dependent on it as much as I was addicted to what it did for me.
So you mentioned that one of the things that was so appealing was that it numbed these feelings that you had and other things that were happening in your life. Do you think that that was part of why this was a problem for you because of the all of the other things that were happening in your life at the time?
Yeah, I think that the one of the main reasons that I became dependent on it versus addicted to it was because I wasn't getting the right mental health treatment. And I think that is a huge percentage of our problem today with this crisis that we're in is our mental health system lacks. People don't know where to turn. They're not getting the right mental health stuff. Parents aren't helping their kids with mental health. I think a lot of it starts out with poor mental health. You know, I was an overweight high schooler. I was an overweight young adult. I had to have the gastric bypass surgery. I was in a very abusive relationship. And all of a sudden you have a magic medication that takes all of that away. And you know, you're addicted to that.
Scott, what do you think about that?
The question of addiction versus dependence?
Yeah, and the question of other things that, you mentioned you were lonely and you had anxiety and here's this thing and you know, this sort of magic bullet. And do you think that had an effect on your decisions around using?
Certainly, that was a big part of it. And I think something changed eventually for me at some point where even thinking about those feelings or dealing with them in other ways wasn't a consideration. In attempting to manage my use of opiates, I eventually just became an alcoholic and developed an incredible addiction to benzodiazepine medications. And in doctor shopping and in purchasing alcohol legally, I just found that when it came to seeking out or acquiring substances, it became a matter of automatic processing, that I eventually even stopped considering alternatives to what I was doing and forgot what I was coping with or why I had originally started down this road.
Today on the show, we're listening back to an interview that we first aired live in April. We were joined by two Vermonters who had experience with opioid addiction, Trish Lafayette of Bristol and Scott Pavek of Burlington, and we listened to their perspectives and opinions. We also heard from many listeners who themselves had struggled with addiction. Here's one who called in, Scott from Northfield.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just called. I have a similar experience to everyone else, I guess. I was injured in 1997. I fractured my heel, very painful injury, had some surgeries, was prescribed pain medication for my injury, got addicted to it. I ended up on pain medication for about 17 years. It was all prescribed by my doctor. At first it was needed, and then I was just using it because I was addicted. I liked the way it made me feel. I liked the high. And I ended up, you know, lying to my doctor for years and years, telling him I was in pain and I wasn't. Was prescribed the pills for, like I said, about 17 years. One day I had a little bit of an overdose experience that really got me to thinking. I ended up talking to my doctor, made a doctor's appointment, called my wife, had her come to my doctor's appointment, and told him that I was abusing the medication.
So, Scott, you said you were abusing the medication, and then what?
Well, like I said, I had an overdose experience. My wife pulled into the driveway. I was looking out the window. I became, had cold sweats, dizzy, felt, faint. I just didn't feel right. I felt like, something was wrong. I ended up getting in the shower, kind of came around before I had to see my wife. but I knew right then that I was on a runaway train and I needed some help.
And did you get it?
So I, yep, I talked to my doctor. I had my wife come and I was put on a methadone treatment. I think I did like 8 weeks on a methadone you know, I was on methadone to come down off the pain medication, and I have been completely clean of pain medication for the last 4 years.
Scott, I'm really glad to hear that and appreciate you being willing to share your story today on the show. Thank you for that. We got a note from Erica who says, thanks very much to both of the guests for talking about something that must be scary to talk about publicly. Please let us know what friends, as opposed to family, could do for someone who's in this situation. I have a friend who's clearly addicted because of some fairly serious pain, and I'm not sure what to say or do. The pain issue also complicates it because in this case, it's chronic. Scott, what would you say to Erica about how somebody who's a friend might be able to be supportive?
That's, first of all, Erica, thank you for sharing that. And that's an incredibly hard question. And unfortunately, I don't have the single right answer. I would say I always benefited from friends who approached me honestly with concern and who definitely grounded themselves or their approach to my problem in a medical perspective, understanding that they were concerned for my health and for my well-being, and not that, you know, I was a bad person or that I had a moral deficiency, but just starting from a place of compassion, which it sounds like you're already in, and then honestly turning to the experts that do this for a living, that know better than I about what resources or what information you can provide to your friend if she seems receptive.
Were there people who approached you in a different way that did suggest that you had a moral failing or something like that?
Certainly. And it's the same people over the course of my active addiction that came to understand what this really is and support me now. But certainly when I understood it less myself, it wasn't, you know, uncommon to interact with authority figures. Certainly when I was a kid who just told me that this was a matter of choice and that, you know, I certainly shouldn't be doing something so illegal. But yeah, that was the message I received.
What did that do when you got that message?
It made me angry. It made me angry at times. It made me feel misunderstood and even more alone. It encouraged me, I think, to continue to hide my habits regardless of what consequences they brought about, and to just stay in silence, I guess.
We got another note, this one from Barb, who says, this discussion is very timely for me. My daughter just this past week told me of her addiction to painkillers. Please let me know if there was something you would have liked a parent to say that would have made a difference. I'm just heartbroken. Trish, do you have advice for Barb?
Yeah. My mom was very supportive. She was with me every day, though I wasn't a minor. I was still her kid, and she didn't really know until after I confessed to her, and she did all the right things. She was very supportive. They were, they mandated treatment. They helped me get treatment. They took care of my kids. They were very supportive. I just think that you can be as loving and supportive as you can to your daughter, try to help her find treatment. If I have any, advice to give, it would be that you look into the reasons why she's using and try to get to the bottom of those, whether it's depression or some sort of mental health, try to help her with those. My mom was just not judging and very supportive and by my side the whole time, and loving her and being next to her is just going to be like the most of what she's going to need you to do. And that's about it.
Scott?
Sorry to have a little aside here. I mentioned earlier in the conversation that my mom had to ask me to leave the house when my addiction started. Just want to clear the air and let everyone know my mom is my biggest supporter. Love you, Mom. Thank you for everything. I appreciate it. Thanks for keeping me alive.
Scott, can I ask you to talk a little bit about that, though? Not necessarily that interaction with your mom, but that idea of, you know, when it feels appropriate, or now that you're looking back on it, for somebody to say, you can't be here if you're doing that, versus being supportive once somebody has told you, I'm in addiction, I am addicted to painkillers, and maybe the different responses to those two things.
It's such a challenge, and I have a lot of empathy for the people that have to be support first in this crisis. because the walking the line between really helping someone and enabling them, it's an incredible tightrope. I don't know how to answer those questions myself. I know that, you know, despite their best intent, a lot of the relatives who did support me over the years financially, a lot of time that money wasn't going to the purpose that they thought it was going towards. But if you can provide support financially by, you know, giving someone a stable place to live and paying bills directly, I guess that's the one piece of advice to say to avoid enabling someone in active addiction. But it's truthfully just a huge challenge.
Mm. Trish, your sister was really crucial to you in getting into recovery and getting into treatment. Will you tell us that story about how that happened?
Sure. When I realized that I was too deep into heroin, about 4 weeks into it, I knew that I had to quickly tell somebody. And when an addict decides that window is not very long. They won't keep that decision very long. So I called her up and she came to my defense right away. And I just blurted out quickly that I'm addicted to heroin. She did all the right things. So she didn't right away. She didn't let me leave her sight. She got me into my doctor that day. She drove me 2 hours to treatment. She took care of my kids. She stayed right by my side the whole time and right to the point of even having tabs on my phone so that, you know, when I made the wrong choices to call my dealer again in between detox and treatment, she was there to intervene. And, That's the kind of family member that everybody needs. They need someone who's going to be right there the whole time and just not let you out of their sight. But at the same token, she wouldn't give me any money. You know, she gave me a place to live. She took care of my children. She supported me. She took me, you know, to rehab and to treatment. But she didn't give me any money and she didn't give me any way to keep using.
At the time, were you saying to her, you're doing the right things? Or were you saying something else to her?
No, I got pretty upset when she signed into my cloud on my phone and intervened the deal that could have really saved my life. Like, you know, had she not have signed into my cloud and intervened in me, you know, I went to 5-day detox. And then when I was home for 2 weeks waiting for treatment is when I decided I may as well use some more for a couple weeks. So I texted my dealer and she intervened. I was angry with her. But that intervention probably saved my life. I probably would not have made it to treatment.
What's your relationship with your sister like now?
Oh, we're really close. We're best friends. We both have children and we're in each other's lives every day. We're definitely best friends.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
We have a caller calling in from Burlington right now. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. I asked not to have my name used because I'm still dealing with a going on 15 year now addictions and tried off and on to get clean. Finally went to rehab and I just want to make like two comments. One is that one of the things that struck me at rehab was, and I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that, like it seemed like 9 out of 10 people that I talked to, got to know, had all suffered abuse as children. And so, I mean, I think kind of if the conversation wants to go to, you know, how does this happen to people, then it seems like that would be something that, you know, to look at. The other thing is this, my other comment is about the availability of heroin on the streets here in Burlington. It is incredibly easy. I mean, really incredibly easy. And what happens a lot of times, what happened to me, I got out of rehab and went back to my kind of not very nice apartment building. And, you know, there's 3 or 4 other addicts there. So, you know, I'm trying to get clean and, you know, I'm walking in my door and, you know, I have a neighbor offering me bags of heroin. So that makes it extremely, extremely difficult, you know, to get away from it. So I'll just... You know, if you all want to comment on that, that's
well,
fine. Well,
before you go, I'd love to know what you think. I mean, you mentioned that so many people have had trauma in their lives, and you talk about that in rehab. So what do you think would help?
Well, I guess one reason why it was so striking to me is that's not my experience, you know? I mean, I had a pretty good childhood and teenage years and whatever, but... Oh, well, I mean, obviously it's got to start with dealing with, you know, child abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, sexual, emotional, physical. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up. And Trish, you mentioned that earlier, that mental health and dealing with mental health and having parents who are paying attention to their children's mental health is a key part, you think.
Yeah, I think my opinion is that is a huge part. Like, you know, as the caller said, that it's so common to hear about trauma in everyone's lives and that's what they're trying to cover up. And that's what they are, you know, that's what got them using. And that's so common. Instead, our school system should be teaching skills to cope with emotions and emotion recognition and emotion regulation. And those are the things that we should be focusing on teaching our kids and really keeping close track of their mental health and their anxiety and their stress levels, because those are the things that are going to get you a child who turns to addiction in some shape or form, whether it be food or drugs. So I strongly believe our mental health system needs to step up.
Scott, what do you think?
Truthfully, I struggle with the whole correlation and causation arguments in terms of what really causes any of this. It's easy to meet a lot of well-adjusted people who fall into this pattern. But truthfully, I think the important thing to keep in mind is provision of mental health services for people that are in recovery or beginning that, because it's easy to experience a lot of trauma while in active addiction, and then you continue to use to mask the memories of yesterday. And that cycle is pretty defeating. So, yeah.
You and I have talked on Twitter about our relative experiences going through. I went through the DARE program, the drug abuse education program in school. And you were saying, well, it's not that effective if you've already started using by the time you get the message, just say no.
Right.
So instead of something like this sort of drug abuse education, what do you think would be effective in schools at an early age to try to teach young people the coping skills that Trish was talking about, but also the dangers of addiction that aren't just like, don't do it?
It's hard because anecdotally, speaking with educators today, I'm pretty impressed with what I hear about programs in Vermont and the conversations that are being had publicly. It's certainly not the experience I had, but I would say being honest and consistent in messaging in terms of communicating the risks of different substances, certainly that just say no approach is undermined if you tell kids using any substance will ruin their lives, but then they see responsible, normal adults using marijuana or drinking alcohol. We just have to be honest that there are differences between intoxicants.
We're listening back today to an interview we first aired in April when we tried to touch down from high altitude views of the opioid crisis and instead listen to the stories and perspectives of two Vermonters with direct experience with addiction, Scott Pavick in Burlington and Trish Lafayette from Bristol. There was a lot of response to the discussion, including one listener who emailed in to ask the guests if they also considered dealers to be users who were worthy of compassion. I turned to Scott to answer that question.
Yeah, I can answer that. I've been a dealer, and I was sick. And you'll see that a lot with street-level sales. It's a community of people who are using, scraping money together. Sometimes someone will have enough to distribute. I think that there's certainly a difference between, I guess, the kingpins you see prosecuted at the federal level. But certainly if we're just going to have a blanket, I guess, moral judgment on anyone who's ever distributed a drug, you're going to be passing judgment on a lot of sick people who are just trying to get well.
Trish?
Yeah, I agree. I don't ever, you know, blame or hold any, you know, anger to my dealer. I speak about her wanting me to be addicted and that sort of thing. But that's all because it's true. She would need compassion too. And she was definitely addicted and she was dealing to support her habit and she was the same as me. She wasn't different. I've been angry with her at a time or two in my recovery process as well. But she definitely does need, dealers definitely do need compassion and they need help because they're addicted and sick too.
Hmm. Let's go to Peter in Hinesburg. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had a bit of a different experience with my addiction. So I have been in recovery for 5 years. And my life is great now, but I was, during my active addiction, I was a terrible person. I started out by buying, you know, pills on the street, and it quickly progressed to heroin. And I was not personally able to hold a steady job. I would get really sick, call out of work, all those things, you know, and so I had to fund my addiction by stealing mostly from, you know, my family, my mother, my grandmother, whether it was writing bad checks out of their checkbooks or stealing their jewelry and pawning it off or just their money. And I still struggle with that every day, knowing that I did all those things to my family. But luckily, they have forgiven me, and I have a really good family dynamic now. Our relationships are pretty well healed, but yeah, I was a really bad person.
Peter, thank you for sharing. Scott, I know you wanted to respond to Peter.
Peter, thank you for saying that, but I just got to tell you, I disagree with something you said. You said when you were in active addiction, you were a terrible person. I would strongly disagree with that, Peter. I think you were a sick person who was doing whatever it took to get well. At least that's what your brain told you you were doing. When I was near the end of my active addiction, I was living in an apartment where I quit paying the utilities, waiting to get kicked out or starve to death. I was holding down a job, washing dishes, just because someone knew that if I was washing dishes in that restaurant, I wasn't out using, committing crimes, or I wasn't going to die while I was in that restaurant. So certainly you can hit whatever you think your rock bottom is. You can do whatever you did. But just know that thinking that you are a terrible person, that's the kind of thinking that keeps people sick.
Peter, how does that resonate with you? I mean, I imagine you have compassion for others who are in active addiction or have been using, but maybe not for yourself. So what do you think about what Scott said?
Well, I've always struggled with accepting myself, you know, and the things that I've been through. But I do certainly have compassion for other people, and I certainly understand what you're saying. You know, I was really sick, and it was just a constant race to get well, like you said. I can never forgive myself for anything that I've done in the past. I have an issue with forgiving myself over things.
Well, Peter, I think there's a lot of compassion in this room for you. And Scott?
Peter, I'll forgive you until you're ready to forgive yourself. That's fine.
Scott, how did you get yourself into recovery and get yourself to the point where you are today?
I didn't get myself anywhere. Somebody came and picked me up. So I was living in Arizona at the time and spent a year in active addiction out there, reaching that, I guess, bottom, as you want to call it, or the end of my use, when an offer that I never anticipated materialized. And truthfully, it's a little hard to explain, but I was just offered the chance to go to a lot of inpatient treatment facilities for free, despite not having insurance or any money to my name or really, you know, submitting an application. These things were just offered to me. And somebody came out to me and found me in Arizona and told me they would help me get clean. They said this was my chance to get my life on track, return to Vermont, go back to school. And I said no. I said, absolutely not. I could handle it myself. I'll figure this out on my own. I don't want to uproot myself. I mean, I'm doing well washing dishes here. And about 3 days, that offer stood. I eventually got into treatment. And over the course of 2013, I spent 7 non-consecutive months in residential treatment facilities. And that's not what it takes for everyone, but that's what it took for me. And I can't tell you what it takes to get clean or how I did it, because the hardest part about being in recovery, now that I can't mask all these hard emotions, is coming to love and understand all those people that were in treatment with me who just didn't ultimately enjoy the same success I've enjoyed after I left.
Trish?
I'd like to just add, you know, to what Scott said about going into residential treatment like multiple times. Like, some people think, oh, I've already been to rehab. I've already tried that once, you know, and I coach a couple of people that have been 3 and 4 and 5 times. And this one girl's mom said, she's already been 6 times. Like, what do you think? You know, do you think this time could be different? And of course it can be. The 7th time can be it. You know, one person can go to rehab one time and inpatient rehab one time and have that be successful. Some people take 6, 7, 10 times, and that 7th or 10th time will work. So don't think that, you know, just because it didn't work a couple of times that it's not going to. It really can. It will work. It can work.
What's the value now for each of you in being willing to be open, being willing to talk about this, you know, being willing to use your names? Because there are a lot of people for whom this is a really private shame still, or a thing that they worry will affect their lives. And you are willing to talk about it. Why?
I want society to look at us differently. I feel like society doesn't understand what we're going through. I feel like society thinks addicts are, you know, do this by choice, and there's some stigma around it. I just want them to know that we are real people, and that we, you know, we're not mean, terrible people that are just choosing to do mean, terrible things. Like we are good people that ended up with an illness. And So the reason I like to be open and honest about it is I just hope my story teaches somebody something. One person helps one person.
Scott, what about for you?
The reason I'm doing this now is, although I have the capacity to be happy in sobriety, I spend a lot of my time feeling guilty and sad. I feel guilty that I haven't done more in my recovery, and I feel sad that I can't help everyone get clean. So the sense that I can do something with this pain, maybe talk to people, talk to legislators about stuff like safe consumption facilities, give back in some way, because truthfully, I'm just sad watching my friends die.
And they're still dying?
Yeah.
You mentioned safe consumption facilities, otherwise known sometimes as safe injection sites. You would like to see that in Vermont?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't really count all the people I've watched die just getting unlucky with one last use, or just because they weren't ready to get into treatment yet. But the idea that we could, you know, make a public policy change, establish medical facilities where people can be supervised, and we can police overdose deaths. Sorry, poor word choice. Prevent overdose deaths more efficiently or effectively. That's just got to happen. It has to.
Trish, anything you'd like to see very quickly?
I'd just like to see more compassion and more support, with everybody being kind and just helping people out that they see, just being more loving and kind.
Well, Trish Lafayette, Scott Pavic, I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts, your stories, your advice with listeners. I think it's powerful to hear people's stories, because this is a human issue, and I appreciate you being willing to talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.